Welcome to the On Script podcast, your home for world-class conversations on scripture and theology, where you get to meet some of the best in the field. Visit us at onscript.study. Say hello on Twitter at onscriptpodcast and stop by our Facebook page at facebook.com/onscript.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the On Script podcast. This is Matt Lynch coming to you from Regent College in Vancouver. Just here at the beginning, I wanted to say a word of thanks to everyone involved with OnScript. There are so many people behind the scenes making this possible. I'm really grateful for them. So we've got the hosts of OnScript. So me, Matt Bates, Drew Johnson, Aaron Heim, Chris Tilling, Amy Brown, Hughes, and Jules Martinez, Olivieri. Also working in media, kind of helping with website or events, Rebecca Terhume, Mim Ward on design logo stuff. On the website, Alan Files and James Steinbach have been superb. Finances, Maria Hearing's going to be helping us with keeping all that in order and straight. On the In Parallel podcast, Brent Strawn hosting their Biblical World podcast, which is another spinoff. We have Chris McKinney, Kyle Keimer, Oliver Hersey, Mary Buck, Mark Jansen, and Amy Balo. And then our intrepid producers, Jason Stark and Taylor Terzik, and then Keith Willis producing In Parallel. So a lot of people behind the scenes, and it wouldn't be possible without all of you encouraging us along the way and those of you who give and share the word about what we're doing. So thanks to everyone involved. I just wanted to name them so you can hear who's connected and hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome back to On Script. From our modern vantage point, I think we can all agree that ancient religions are decidedly weird. This is Matthew Bates. Let me read a quote to illustrate some of the strangeness. Greek travel writer Pausanias recounts the story of a famous Greek athlete named Theogenes. After this hero died, his family had a bronze statue made to honor his life. Okay, that isn't so weird yet, but let's continue. Theogenes had a particular enemy who wanted to get back at him, and he did so by beating the statue. All right, that's strange, right? Now, according to Pausanias, the statue fought back and killed the man. And now that's where we get really, really odd. But we're not even done with the story. It's going to get even weirder. Let me introduce today's guest for you, Nijay Gupta, author of the new book, Strange Religion, How the First Christians Were Weird, Dangerous, and Compelling, published by Brazos Press 2024. Welcome back to On Script, Nijay.
Thanks, Matt. It's great to be with you again.
Now, Nijay, we've had you on here before talking about Paul and the language of faith, and right. So it's great. You're an On Script veteran. let's recap the story so far. So we have this Pausanias, who's a travel historian, telling a story about a family who builds a statue to honor one of their dead, and this man has an enemy, and this man comes and physically attacks the statue.
Right.
But at least we have reports that the statue fought back. How does this connect in any way to Greco-Roman religion?
It's this idea of the relationship between heaven and earth, what they would think of as heaven and earth, and this idea that there are these gateways between the world of the gods and the world of mortals. We think in terms of natural and supernatural, but there was more fluidity in the Greco-Roman religious imagination. And so statues would be everywhere. And, you know, I wrote an article on this, you know, maybe about 10 years ago. I'm going to use a little bit of academic speak here. I came up with a term for this, amphicosmic ontology. So amphicosmic meaning two worlds or both worlds. And the statue somehow lives in two worlds at once. And now this statue of Theogenes is a statue of a human, but there would have been statues of deities in every temple. When Paul goes to Athens, he was shocked by all the idols. We're talking about statues that are everywhere. So I kind of liken this to billboards of sports figures or billboards of, you know, Times Square. It would be like that with statues in the Greco-Roman world. They would be everywhere. And they would be so realistic. And this was such a common phenomenon. The idea was these statues, of course, like Billy Bob down the street made this statue. They knew that. But at the same time, they also believed somehow the god could act and be, or a person could act and be, or a spirit through that statue. So there's one scholar that talks about this as bionic statues. Sometimes I use the language of avatar. So this example of theogenies isn't isolated. You would have people who, if their loved one died out at sea, you couldn't recover the body, they'd create a statue and they would bury the statue in their place. You would know this. A lot of funeral inscriptions speak in the first person as if the spirit is still living. And so you'll have a statue or a tombstone that will say, tread lightly on me or go lightly on me because of this and that. It'll speak in the first person. So there's that sense of there is mystery, there is numinous somehow in these objects that we think of as purely natural.
And we might think that's strange until we begin to think about early Christian strangeness, right? That yeah. We obviously, as Christians, believe in some similar ideas connected to this. And we'll maybe draw some connections to this in just a second. But let's finish the story. So what happens next after this statue fights back? That actually isn't the end of the story. What happens next in the story?
Well, the family of, so if the statue murdered this person, the family of that person takes the statue to court in place of that person. I mean, there's this idea that this happened, according to Pausanias, you know, and they take this to court. And then I believe, I can't remember the details, but I believe it's exiled. Is that right?
It's exiled. Yeah, the statue is exiled. So the court finds the statue guilty of fighting against this person and sends the statue into exile. So there's a sense that the hero had reanimated the statue and was guilty for this crime of beating his enemy through the medium of the statue. And so the statue sent into exile, which would send the dead hero into exile. So let's draw some early Christian connections here then. What does it mean to be made in the image of God? How are early Christian ideas similar and dissimilar to what we find in Greco-Roman religion about inhabited statues?
Well, you know, if you were to sit down and map out what are the absolute necessities, if you were going to start your own religion, which was going to be a bad idea because new religions are bad in the ancient world, but if you're going to start your own religion, you're going to need some supplies. You're going to go to the hardware store of the ancient world and you're going to get some supplies. You're going to need temples. You're going to need sacrifices. You're going to need material sacrifices. You're going to need priests. And you're going to need statues. Like, that's like, okay, when you're making your budget for your new religion, these are the things you absolutely must have. Now, let's talk about Jews for a moment, ancient Jews. So they had temple in Jerusalem, which for as much as Jews were scorned in the ancient world by Romans, there was this idea that they had one of the like 10 wonders of the world. You would love, if you were in that area of the world, you would love to visit that temple because of how grandiose it was. Jews had priests. You know, they had thousands of priests. Jews had material sacrifices. It was quite an industry. And now, Jews and then early Christians later on did not have cult statues, and that may have been one of several reasons why Christians were called atheoi. Now, atheoi doesn't mean atheist, even though we get that word from a and theoi. It means those who don't have gods. Romans, when I talk about Romans, I mean Romanized people. Romans, they didn't care so much what you believed in terms of what's in your brain or in your heart. They really wanted to know how that's going to affect your socio-political behavior. Let's put it that way. And so to refuse to honor Jupiter, best and greatest, his title was best and greatest, to refuse to honor Jupiter, to refuse to honor, you know, Lord Caesar, to refuse to honor the main patron deities of your city, and those would happen through the statues, was what they would consider blasphemy. And so they would consider you godless, not because you don't have gods, but because you don't worship the right gods in the right way. You're allowed to have your own gods. See, Matt, this is what I didn't understand until I researched for this book. I thought polytheism is sort of an anything goes. And, you know, I grew up in a Hindu household. My parents are Hindus. So I'm thinking, like, the more the merrier. Now, that's kind of true for the Romans. They thought, okay, if we can add more gods to add more firepower to our team, great. But they actually have to fit into the pyramid of power, the pantheon of Roman power. And so there's a pecking order. There's a hierarchy. And Jews didn't quite fit, but they made certain negotiations, many of them. Christians didn't fit at all. I mean, you wanted a deity that was ancient. And in the first century, you could actually say, I'll introduce you to my deity's parents. Like, that's a kind of a bad sign. You want, you know, temples, priests, sacrifices, statues. Christians didn't have, by 75 AD, Christians didn't have any of these things.
Yeah, so Christianity is distinctively weird, as it doesn't have a temple either, right? As the temple is the church, right? The members of the community that are possessed by the Holy Spirit and have the Holy Spirit filling them. Lots of strange differences between ancient Christian religion and ancient Roman religion, but also some interesting points of contact. And I think really that's the theme of your book, Strange Religion. Like, you're wanting to, on the one hand, say that, hey, isn't ancient Roman religion weird? And isn't Christianity even weirder?
Yeah.
But let's contemplate what the distinctives were within early Christianity that set it apart from Roman religion, and let that all still inform the church today.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's not get rid of the weird parts of early Christianity, because we need to keep Christianity distinct in the midst of our culture. So lots going on in your book. It's a really well-written and thought-provoking book. Now, Nijay, you're from Portland, and as we kind of think about framing, what does it mean to keep Christianity weird today in healthy ways? We don't want to be weird just to be weird, but in healthy ways. Tell us some of the weirdness that you're experiencing on the left coast in the U.S. today, and why that makes this an important quest in your book to try to think about what it means to stay weird in healthy ways.
Well, the introduction to my book lays out some of the reasons why I wrote Strange Religion. I am a history nerd. I love ancient history. I love reading books in the category of classics. I studied classics in college. But the book really, in terms of the heart reasons, comes out of my experience, especially since 2016, politically, and especially with the pandemic, and basically the reputation of Christianity in America. I live in Portland, as you mentioned, which is heavily unchurched. And in general, Portland is known for being weird, but also focusing on local versus, you know, commercial, unique versus mass production, some of those things. And so I talk about conformity as a four-letter word here in Portland. And I think about the reputation of Christianity. And for a lot of my unchurched friends here in Portland, what they know about Christianity, they know really from the news. And what they're reading about is stuff about scandals, Jerry Falwell Jr., or what's going on with Southern Baptists, or what's going on with Catholics. And there are great people in a variety of traditions, but what they're hearing on the news is that Christianity is the worst of popular American culture. Christianity reflects and amplifies racism, sexism, greed, narcissism, commercialism, all of that. Now, I know in my local church, there's some amazing things going on. But Christianity, to many of the people around me, is not weird. It's not weird in the sense of attractive and compelling. It's basically some religious papering over popular culture, the worst of popular culture. So I use this analogy to be in my book. You know, I'll just give you a little insider information. I wanted to write a book that was going to connect more with ecclesiology. I didn't end up doing much of that because after I'd written the book as kind of a history of early Christianity, I just stopped. And I just sent it to my publisher and I sent it to my editor and I said, hey, I think I'm done. Like, I want this to be a history book. He said, okay, you're going to have to do something to grab the reader in the introduction. So I rewrote the introduction. So I actually used the illustration of coconut water. And so far, people have liked this illustration. I discovered coconut water when I lived in Philadelphia, bought it at the gas station just to try it. And it was a clear liquid. I'm thinking coconut water is clear, like, you know, a refreshing beverage. And I go to Costco here in Portland thinking I'm going to buy some coconut water. And the big package of like 24, whatever it is pink. The liquid is pink. I'm thinking, okay, what is wrong with this? Like, did it like turn bad? So I go to another package. It's also pink. And so I like inspect it closer. All the packages are pink. And there's actually a label that says, why is this pink? So I read it. And what happens is when real coconut water, when you open up a coconut, when real, when that water is extracted and put into a bottle or whatever, naturally, once it touches oxygen, it's going to turn pink, the oxygenation. There's nothing wrong with it. However, what they say on this label is a lot of companies will chemically alter it to make it look clear because that's what people, they think people want. So in people's minds, they think, I want a clear beverage. That makes it pristine. And so a pink one isn't. So instead of explaining why it's pink, they actually transform it into something clear. And I thought, oh my gosh, have we done that with Christianity? Where we have chemically altered it to make it more palatable to the masses. And so the whole point of calling Christianity weird is not our hairstyles or our hobbies, or but to say, if the core values of the Jesus people, the Jesus way, make us different than other groups of people, we have to find ways to secure our identity in that and not be kind of drifting like a magnet to what everybody else is doing. I'm not saying popular culture is always bad. I'm not saying American culture is always bad. I like some of the freedoms and rights and opportunities I have. But what I'm going to, you know, I actually have this quote at the very beginning of my book. I'm sure you like this one from...
I have a good one for you.
From Celsus.
Oh, the one from the Contra Celsum. No.
Yeah, Celsus.
Here's a good quote that summarizes what you were just saying. And it reflects some of your good style in the book. You say, I do think pop Christianity in the Western world often reflects a chemically altered version of the Jesus movement. I love this part, that has been manufactured for cheap refreshment.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, well, that might come from Celsus here, because Celsus is opponent of early Christianity. He says, if all men wanted to be Christians, the Christians would no longer want them. Now, this is an exaggeration, but I love this because what he's saying is these people are completely backwards and upside down and inside out. And he's saying they don't conform. They don't conform to Romanness. They don't conform to religion as we know it. And I don't think someone like Paul or someone like James is doing it to be weird. I think they're saying, we have a different leader, we have a different way. We have a different deity. And so in the Greco-Roman world, it was seen as a great contest of the gods. Think about Hesiod's Theogony, which is this great competition between the gods and who wins. And Zeus, if you watch Percy Jackson, you learn that Zeus came out on top and the Titans were mad. And here you have Jesus, who does things completely differently. And it is going to be a threat if he doesn't fall into line. And so I wrote this book really to say there is a natural drift that happens if we aren't paying attention to what our foundation is. So what I tell people is the core question behind my book is, would our spiritual ancestors recognize us as their true descendants? And I would say not entirely, but mostly no.
Chemically altered is what you would say. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, let me introduce my guest a little bit more fully. Nijay K. Gupta has his PhD from Durham and is professor of New Testament at Northern Seminary. And all this, though this wasn't actually the case when we initially planned this interview, we're now colleagues in New Testament at Northern. Nijay has written numerous books, including recent titles such as Tell Her Story with IVP academic, Galatians in the Story of God commentary series, and then also the Word Biblical Themes Galatians book, and one of my personal favorites I've already mentioned, Paul and the Language of Faith, which was with Erdmans. Gupta blogs at cruxsolablog.com. He also has a Substack, and when he's not working, he likes to cook Asian food, watch superhero movies, drink good coffee, and watch soccer with his wife, Amy, and his kids.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So in chapter one, Nijay, you kind of give, I think, an overarching framework for thinking about the gods in the Roman world and what it meant for humans to relate to gods. And I think this is really critical framing for all of us, because we might just import our own cultural understandings about how a person should relate to religion or gods. And that's the category of the Pax Deorum, the peace with the gods. What does this mean? Why was it important to keep peace with the gods? And how was the whole framework of ancient Roman religion quite different from contemporary frameworks of religion?
Yeah, this is huge, because we really have to it'll actually help us better understand early Judaism, early Christianity, if we understand how the conceptions of ancient religion in general. So let's say today, and I'm kind of generalizing, but let's say today religion in America is often seen as private. It's a choice, and it's for personal fulfillment. Now, not everybody thinks that way, but generally speaking, there's kind of a marketplace of religion. You sort of choose what fits you. And it's like people say, oh, I don't, you know, put it on my resume. I don't, you know, flash it about, you know, think about like with the presidential election, how religious should the person be? Can we have, you know, a Muslim president or a Hindu president? You know, a lot of people say, oh, it's not affecting my decisions, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we could see the private element. There's that sense of choice, conversion. I was this and now I became that. And then personal fulfillment, like, does it make me happy? Does it lead to more flourishing? Ancient people, generally speaking, did not think in those terms. It was an obligation. It was very public. In fact, they had a kind of separate religion for inside the house. You would worship honoring the lar familiaris, the household spirit, and the panis or panates, the deity of the storehouse and then the hearth. But then religion was basically public. And instead of thinking about a deity as kind of like a genie that like gives me things I want, you have to think about the gods more like overlords. They're like political overlords. So think about like colonizers. And you owe them worship. It wasn't sort of like, oh, God, please give me this these things. I promise I'll be good. It was like, these people are in charge. And my obligation to the state is the Pax Deorum, which means peace with the gods, or you might say peaceful coexistence with the gods. So I kind of liken this to the mafia in my book, where, like, say you have a neighborhood, you know, convenience store, and, you know, the gang or the mafia come and they say, you know, we will protect you, in quotes, if you pay us some taxes. And the idea was you don't really have a choice, but they will protect you from rival gangs, and you try to just get by and no one gets hurt. And so it was obligatory, and it wasn't really for personal fulfillment. There wasn't a direct connection in most people's minds to an afterlife. They did have some understanding of, you know, Elysium or whatever. It's not talked about as often as we talk about heaven and hell, but there was a vague notion, but they didn't really connect that to worshiping the gods. It was really a here and now sort of thing. It was preserve the state, preserve my family. And it was an obligation. It was just something you absolutely had to do. And so to protect Rome, to protect your city, to protect your family, and to seek flourishing, you had to worship these gods. You just had to. And there was no reason not to. You went to the festivals. And, you know, if you're good, you might get something in return. You know, if you play along, you're going to get some in turn. But there's, I love one of these examples. This again relates to a statue. You know, there was, I think the Romans had gone out against the people of Tyre, the Tyrians. And the Tyrians were afraid they were going to lose the battle. And they thought their patron deity, Apollos, was going to abandon them. So they tied down the statue with gold chains bronze chains, so that the statue wouldn't fly away and abandon them. So this was this idea that you want to do right by your gods, and you don't want them to abandon you. You don't want them to come out in wrath against you.
But the gods are fickle, and they're arranged in a hierarchical power struggle themselves, right?
Yes.
And so all of that is reflected in concerns that the ancient people have of protection from the gods, as the gods may not be in a position sometimes to protect. You had a chapter, your second chapter, that was on early Christian faith, and we've already discussed that extensively on Script. Am I right in saying that you see this as a way, though, that Christianity was quite different in the midst of the Greco-Roman system, right? That Christians emphasized this personal faith, and that maybe pushes Western civilization toward the trajectory that we see today. Anything you wanted to say about faith, or is it my sensibility right? Is that how you see it fitting in?
Yeah, and actually this was kind of the academic starting point in my book. I was giving a lecture on Paul, the Language of Faith, and someone in the audience had asked, did other religions of the time refer to themselves as believers? Because this was, you know, the Christians didn't call themselves Christian as a whole until probably towards the end of first century. So what did they call themselves in the 40s and 50s? They called themselves brothers and sisters. They called themselves Hagioi saints or holy people, and they called themselves, you know, a form of pistoi or pistuo, believers. And not always do they say believers in what. Sometimes they use it as what I call an absolute, believers versus unbelievers. And what I realized is Romans didn't actually use the language of belief much for religion because they took their beliefs for granted. It wasn't a question of whether the gods existed or not. It was a question, really, sometimes they argued about which ones were stronger and better, like we do with superheroes, like Captain Marvel versus Thor, or whatever, you know, like the way that we do that, that's how they would do it with the gods. But they didn't question. You have some philosophers, and philosophers are kind of a different category. Socrates was kind of killed for questioning the traditional gods and introducing new divinities. But generally speaking, they didn't call themselves believers. So this idea of believing something completely different than what everybody else believes would come across as bizarre, dangerous. Dangerous would be the most common word I would use. So, for example, I think one of the writers, and I can't remember who it was, might have been Plutarch, but he talks about how, like, the most important way to honor the gods was through ritual. And one ancient writer, and I don't remember off the top of my head who it was, he said there were four people, there were four professionals on hand. One person to do the ritual, one person to read the ritual instructions, one person to check the ritual, and one person to force the observers to observe silence. And I think it was Cicero, if I believe, who said, what you believe doesn't actually matter. In the sense that that's not the most important thing. The most important thing is what you do. And Mary Beard, one of my favorite historians, she refers to in Roman religion as ritual is their creed in practice, Roman creed in practice. Sacrifice and ritual were Roman creed in practice. And so what really matters is what they do in practice. And I think it was Cicero who said, when you focus too much on belief, you're actually going to get distracted from the ritual. And what matters is whether you do the ritual correctly. And then you have something like Romans 14 and 15, where Paul says, there could be preference. And what really matters is conscience. This, I think, flies in the face of Roman practice. They would say, who cares what you think? The question is, what does the God actually want practically from you? And Paul says in Romans 12, offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. I mean, it was for some of these reasons that Christians said, we believe in a completely different way of looking at the world. We believe in this invisible God. We believe in this Jesus who I can't actually point to because there's no statue of him. We worship without temples. There were all these reasons to say we believe something completely differently, and we embrace this by faith and not by sight.
Yeah, I think you're having a special strength, too, in pointing out the covenant faithfulness, dimensions of pistis and belief. So it wasn't just purely a private thing, but a kind of a covenant that God had entered into with all the people, too. I think that we can think of them as both believers and loyalists as we think about how they related to this King Jesus. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you sort of touched on is, okay, ancient religion's persnickety. Right? The Romans were very exacting about how they wanted things done.
Yes.
But Christianity actually didn't make the cut. It didn't make the status of religion. It was instead thought to be a superstition. Right? Mm-hmm. So what's the difference between a religion and a superstition? I think that was one of the more helpful sections of the book. I really enjoyed where you walk through the different frameworks that kind of marked out an official religion from something that was a little more suspect. So your four categories, well, I'll let you walk us through them a bit. But the first one was ancient versus innovative. What's the difference? Why is one a religion and the other a superstition?
Yeah, let me talk about these categories a little bit. And one of the bridges I had to cross is whether I actually use the language of religion or not, because there's a huge controversy. I think of people like Jonathan Zed Smith. There's a huge controversy over whether we should use the word religion. And I've had some people, you know, sling some arrows at me on social media about even using the word religion, even in my title strange religion.
That's more of an Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment even like framework, right? That's more like 19th century where we begin to talk about like the study of religions and comparative religions. And yeah, I mean, they use the ancient word religio, didn't mean religion in the same sense that we mean it, right?
So yeah. So I spend time defining this. I thought, okay, I'm going to use it because it's going to make the most sense to people because we're talking about honoring the gods. And we're talking about devotion, which was something that ancient people were obsessed with. So I think it's better to use it and define it than not use it. So instead of using the word religion, I actually, beginning on, you know, early on in the book, I actually use the word religio, which was the common word for honoring the gods. And then their other term would be cultus, and where we get the word cult. So there isn't like a rule book on this, the difference between religion and superstition or religio and superstitio. There isn't a rule book, but there's a pattern. And so I talk about this in the book. And the pattern is religio would refer to proper devotion to gods and superstitio, dangerous or volatile engagement with the divinity or the divine world. So I have four categories and I just kind of had to come up with these myself based on patterns I see in Plutarch. And in, you know, inscriptions and other things and graffiti and all sorts of things. So the first one, ancient. So the older your god, the better. So Jews kind of, you know, you read Josephus or you read Philo and they talk about how old their religion is. They talk about Moses as this great legislator and leader of this people. And it goes way, 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 way back, you know, Jewish antiquities and all that. Versus, so religio, ancient, good. Superstitio, innovative, bad. And so Rome policed new religions very carefully. So, for example, mystery cults.
Oh, we're talking about that later. Yeah.
Mystery
cults. No talking about mystery cults yet, NJ. No talking about
mystery cults. Okay. Well, mystery cults, they had professionals that were keeping an eye on these things. Kind of the way that we talk about border security and the way America is both seen as bring us your, you know, your downtrodden. But then we also say we police the border. So Rome said, bring us your gods, but we police which gods come in and why. Second, good religion is ritualized. You know, do you have strong rituals? Is it written down? Is there a code book? Is it policed? Are there professionals versus ecstatic? Is it sort of anything goes? Is it just sort of like, you know, let's get wild and let things happen? Third, corporate. Is there constant to it? Is it a communal broadly across the board, or is it individualized? Is it up to the individual? And lastly, is it effective, meaning you do the ritual, it's done, the god's happy, end of story? Or is it desperate? Now, actually, I get this from Plutarch because he wrote this really great tract called On Superstition. And one of his criticisms of Judaism, this is funny, I think. One of his criticisms of Judaism is, look at these, and I'm just pretending to be Plutarch here. Look at these Jews. They sit in their temple all the time. Now, you and I, Matt, would think that was devotion, but Plutarch interprets this as desperation because in his mind, all you got to do is make the sacrifice, salute, and take off. You don't need to stay there. Like, it'd be like, you know, trying to get a loan from the bank. You're not going to stay there all day. You're going to apply for the loan, be nice, say hello, fill out the forms, and leave. And so this idea of desperation, it's kind of too much, right? It's overwhelming. And as opposed to effective, just fill out the forms, do your work, say your goodbyes. And so if you look at that right column, Christianity checks a lot of those boxes in Roman eyes.
Yeah, it's interesting. It does in its early days. It's interesting to think about how as time goes on, like Christianity takes on the character of more a Roman-style religion. As obviously in earliest Christianity, there's no evidence of priests, right? The sacramental system is not very developed. But then later on in church history, you'll have the ex opere operato idea of the sacraments, that they're effective by virtue of the work performed, right? Which would be a very Roman idea. Like you just do the sacrifice and it's good. It's not, you know, you're good to go, right? You don't need to do anything else and your attitudes don't matter. It's interesting that it seems like early Christianity became increasingly Romanized when you think about some of these categories. Anyway, I thought it was super helpful. Those categories, I think, are grounded well in ancient sources, even though they were ones that you, as a contemporary observer, are formulating. So you have three chapters toward the center of your book. I think we'll want to kind of walk through some of Christianity's strange beliefs. But before we do that, let's kind of lighten things up here. Let's do a speed round. And to you've done this before, so you kind of know what's coming. Short answers here, Nijay, and more gut level reactions. So speed round, we'll maybe even do two speed rounds if we have time, but speed round number one then. What's your favorite genre of music?
Oh, gosh. Favorite genre of music. I love kind of folksy acoustic stuff. So my kids are really into Noah Kahan right now. So I would say we've been listening to a lot of Noah Kahan.
Noah Kahan? I don't know Noah Kahan. That's more my genre, too. I like Gregory Alan Isakov. He's one of my favorites. I don't know if you know him, but Noah Kahan. Okay, I just have to check that out. All right, so Nijay, what animal sound can you most convincingly imitate? I mean, can you crow for us like a rooster or moo like a cow? Like, what's your best animal? Can you do it for us?
Okay. My best is an elephant, but it's going to be a little ear piercing.
Okay, so let's
be ready for it.
Let's do it. I couldn't hear that.
You couldn't hear it?
I couldn't hear it. No, no.
All right, let's try it.
It's so high. I think it's cutting out on my earphones. I don't know. Maybe you're just faking me out. This is April Fool's Day that we're recording this. I could actually hear you just very faintly. It's interesting.
That's funny.
Well, you know, if you catch, you know, Nijay in person, you'll have to say, like, Nijay, I need to hear the elephant blast.
Yep, I will do it.
Just to see if it was a microphone issue or what it was. All right. So next question, is relish an acceptable food?
It is. I mean, I've lived in England. They love relish. Europeans love relish. I'm not a big sweet relish person. I'm more of a sour and savory. But yeah, I'll eat almost anything.
All right. What's a fiction book you'd recommend?
Oh, a fiction book I would recommend. Good question. I'm going to confess to you, I actually don't read much fiction, even though I know it's a very smarty pants thing to do.
That's a smarty pants thing. You just read monographs. You're just a nerd. You're sitting around reading.
Okay. The most we do is we do with our kids. So I would say if you have younger kids, the Andrew Peterson, Wing Feather.
We're reading that series to our kids right now. We do read alouds in our family, and we're right in the middle of North. We're getting to the end of North or Be Eaten right now.
Yes.
It's a great title. It's book two in the Wing Feather saga, but that is a fantastic series.
This is a good point to recommend. I've actually created a fiction companion to Strange Religion, and it's called Strange Encounter. And it's a story about two Romans who encounter Christianity. It's fiction. It's from the first century. And follow me on socials. You'll see it. But yeah, two episodes have come out already.
I'm behind. I read episode one. I liked it, but I'm behind. So I got to catch up. But it is a nice companion to kind of bring to life Strange Religion for everybody. So Nijay, final speed round question here. What is something weird about you that you don't mention in the book?
Weird about me. Okay.
Yeah, weird about you. Something weird about you.
Weird about me.
I mean, you already revealed you're a hippie. You drink coconut juice. Like,
I do.
What's something else weird about you, Nijay?
I have an electric bicycle. And so it's not that unusual in Portland, but it is, generally speaking, not as common. Mm-hmm. But I love mm-hmm. my life.
The hippie yuppie index is going up, you know, as we rate your life. An electric bike. I'm envious of that, actually. I want an electric bike. That sounds like fun.
It's fun.
Because you don't have to pedal.
My wife and I will do kind of charity bike races things, and she's a hardcore
charity bike race.
I'm not. So I brought it a couple times, and I'm scoffed at, but I don't sweat a drop, so it's one of
them. All right, well, back to Strange Religion. How the first Christians were weird, dangerous, and compelling. So you have three central chapters where you actually explore four different concepts that unpack some of the strangeness of early Christianity. I'll just quickly, for the reader's sake, walk through the four, but then maybe we can develop them a bit. The first is the supremacy of Jesus. The second is that early Christians have a cult, but without smoke and blood. And the third was being possessed by the Spirit of God. And the fourth one, the beginning as the end of all things, or at the end of all things. So the end of all things is particularly important to Christians as a horizon mm-hmm. for their lives. How about the supremacy of Jesus? Now, we might think on the one hand, you already alluded to it earlier, like the more the merrier within Greco-Roman pantheon. So what's the big deal about making Jesus supreme? Is it just that he's in competition with Zeus when you do that? Why were early Christians weird for exalting Jesus?
Yeah, let's say you went to Pompeii and you were just sort of walking the streets in the first century. We know so much about the Roman world from Pompeii and Herculaneum. And thankfully, we know like what colors they used in their art and all that stuff because of the preservation. It's tragic that a volcano had to teach us this, but it's true that we learned so much. We learned about what they eat and, you know, all sorts of stuff. One thing we learn about is how much religious paraphernalia they had. So we know that people worshipped dozens and dozens and dozens of gods. I mean, you just had, you know, you had jewelry, you had art, you had cult niches in your house and all of that. And so most people worship just a multitude of deities for kind of every sort of occasion. And these Christians, similar to Jews, had an unusual exclusivity about them. And so, for example, I tried, Matt, in this book to get out of Christianese. I wanted to drop people in an unfamiliar world. So I try to not use terms like the lordship of Jesus because we've Christianized all this. So I want, okay, what would this mean? This would really mean the supremacy of Jesus. Now, I found this really interesting. I don't know how much I talk about this in the book, but I found this really interesting. I actually wanted to know whether calling Jesus Lord of all, which comes up in Romans and the book of Acts and other things, whether that was a direct strike against the emperor or against Zeus / Jupiter. What I found that was really interesting is the language of being the Lord of all isn't common at all in the Greco-Roman world. I would think Zeus's Lord of all would come up in inscriptions, and a little bit, but not much. Now, when this really started to happen, we're getting a little off track. I think you'll find this interesting. When this really started to happen was actually in the first century. Of the Roman world, when Rome started to experience a financial and cultural decline. I think they had just hit this heyday and then they were coasting downhill. And so there was all this outcry that Rome was kind of going down the tubes. And so you have Dionysius of Halicarnassus, you have Livy, you have others, Virgil, who are talking about an ancient golden age of the world under Saturn. The deity Saturn, where everything was perfect. And they link that to kind of the origins of Rome. And there was this belief in some of these people like Virgil that there was going to be a comeback for Rome. And it was going to coalesce around a particular figure, a particular leader. And that leader that Virgil was backing was actually Octavius, Caesar Augustus. And the idea was that we were going to return to this old golden age and, wait for it, make Rome great again. And why do I tell you this? Because with the emergence of the Imperium, you start to have an increase in the language of allness, a bringing together of everybody under one leader. Now, also around the same time, middle to late first century, you have the statues of Roman emperors that are in the garb of Jupiter. And even when Augustus died and he had his funeral parade, he was dressed up as Jupiter. And the idea was we have to come together for a sort of allness thing. What happens then when the Christians use language of there's no name in heaven on earth or under heaven by which humans could be saved, mortals can be saved? Or where we talk, Paul talks about, you know, Jesus being Lord of all. That's so normal to us Christians. Oh, Jesus is Lord of all. But those are fighting words in the Roman Empire. If you were just sitting at a bar and you just said, I think to a random stranger that you met at the bar, I think Jesus is Lord of all. Like the whole place would get quiet. They'd be like, what are you doing to us, man? like you're going to get struck by lightning the minute you step out this door. You know, it's that sort of thing. Now, I don't think Christians were trying to be all political. They weren't picketing. They weren't writing their senator. Like, they weren't doing that. But these statements are pretty big deal given the history of the Greco-Roman world where Zeus worked so hard to come out on top. I do think the way they talk about this in total and exclusivistic terms is very, very dangerous in a world where Rome is trying to put everybody on the same page.
Yeah, and as a kind of compliment to what you're saying and some things that you bring up in the book is also that Jesus is such a radically different kind of leader than would be expected
to
put forward. Yeah, the crucified criminal as the one who is the supreme leader goes from being edgy to being insane, right?
Yes.
I like that you cover the Alexamenos Graffito, which is that very famous picture that was found in, I believe, on an ancient, the side of an ancient school building.
Like, yes.
It says that—
In Rome.
You know, yeah. What does it say? Alexamenos worships his god, and it's a picture of a donkey, right?
It's a picture of a man on a cross with the head of a donkey and a worshiper standing by, It seems to be like a young person, a teenager's graffiti, and it's basically saying to work, and this is a very early, I don't remember what it's dated to, it's a very early piece of graffiti, the idea that to worship Jesus, someone like Jesus, would be like worshiping a donkey.
So Jesus is a very different kind of leader, so even if it was weird to call him supreme, to call a crucified criminal supreme was sort of like worshiping a donkey in the minds of the ancient Romans. All right, next category, cult without smoke and blood. Why would the lack of priests be highly significant and strange within the Roman world, but why is it also kind of important data for us to take into account as we think about how to keep Christianity strange today?
Yeah, you know, I read this book, you know, in research, sometimes you stumble on a book that just opens things up, unlocks things. I came across this really great book by a historian named F.S. Nyden called Smoke Signals for the Gods. There are all kinds of theories about ancient sacrifice, what it meant to people. Jews had the concept of atonement. Not all sacrifices were for the sake of atonement, but some were. But Greeks and Romans didn't really have that conception of sacrifice. So then the question is, what were they trying to do with sacrifice? And the best argument I've found is really what Nyden argues, that it's basically a gift that you bring to a god to welcome their presence and warm them over to some communication or engagement. So I talk about this like the quarter and the payphone. Back in the day when we had payphones, you know, you only could call a friend collect, so you had to put a quarter in. And the idea was this initiates the communication. And the idea that Nyden has is these sacrifices were to foster goodwill with the deity. And so I open the chapter saying, what is the smell of worship? And, you know, you and I would say it's a good cup of coffee at church or maybe carpet cleaner or whatever it is at our church. But in the ancient world, everyone would have the same answer. It's smoke and blood. And in fact, some of the terminology for sacrifice is the same language for smoke because of how much you'd associate that. So then if you were to go to a Christian gathering where they worship, proskuneo, where they honor God and are pious, you know, eusebia, you'd be like, where are the priests? Where are the sacrifices? Now, the early Christians met in houses usually. We could talk about that later. I would think that the easiest comparative, if you were a Roman and you were invited to a Christian assembly, and then you went home and your children or your spouse says, what was it like? I think they would liken it to a Greco-Roman voluntary club, which are kind of like these fraternities, sororities sort of thing. Because they met in sort of private, semi-private locations. They had a meal often, you know, it was an affinity group. But even those groups would have sacrifices and smoke and rituals and those sorts of things. And Christians had rituals, but they didn't have this. The question is why? The question is why they don't have these things. And the reason that I give is basically because of the Holy Spirit and because of the finished work of Jesus, according to texts like Hebrews, according to Romans, that line of communication is always open. You know, Jesus interceding at the right hand of the Father, the Spirit enabling the cry of Abba, Father. For these reasons, the line is always open. So the example that I give in my book is Christians engage in what I call a religious technology innovation. One of my favorite TV shows is Stranger Things. May have influenced the title of my book. And there's a, it's set in the 80s. There's a scene where there's these people running around a building, running from a monster. And I remember it was Saturday night. I was watching by myself, and it's a scary kind of show. And I remember yelling out to the TV by myself, "Call the police." And then in my mind, I'm thinking, you just pull out your phone and call the police, but they don't have phones in their hands, in their pockets. They have to actually go to a place where there's a phone. And they engage in this religious technology innovation where you don't need to be in a particular place. You don't need a particular device. So it's almost like, do you remember dial-up internet, Matt?
Oh, yeah.
The bings and the bongs. So those young listeners, you might not, you know, ask your parents about this, but when you dialed up in the roaring 90s, you actually were using your phone line to connect to the internet very, very slowly. It'd take like a minute and a half to load your page. And what you're doing is you were connecting and then you had to get off. Remember using the term logging onto the internet? We don't use it anymore because we're not logged on and off anymore. The idea was you get on and you get off, and it's this kind of industrial procedure. What the Christians are doing is they're saying, we are putting spiritual Wi-Fi in your body through the Holy Spirit, mediated and empowered by the Spirit, and operated by Jesus Christ. And so the connection is always on. You don't log on to God. You're always on. And you don't need to warm God over with a material sacrifice, because of Jesus, God is always in a good mood. So I think of Book of Hebrews, let us approach the throne of, and a Roman might say power, judgment, fear, and for Christians, at the throne of grace. But then how do we approach it? With meekness, with, you know, trepidation? No, with confidence, knowing that God is going to give mercy, not because of us, but because of Jesus. So this is a really amazing. Christians don't have smoke and blood, not because they're cheap, not because they're weird to be weird, but because they don't need it. They don't need those things. Now, what I don't want to communicate, and I worry about this in the book, what I don't want to communicate is that Christians were anti-material. They believe that our bodies are sacrifices, not our souls, but our bodies are living sacrifices, and that we are a physical communal body, and that we eat meals together and we serve the poor. So we do things physically material. We don't do it like everybody else.
Yeah. So you kind of talked a little bit about, so we did Cult Without Smoke and Blood. You talked about being possessed by the Spirit of God as part of that. And I think we'll skip past the beginning of the end of all things just for the sake of time, as we're starting to run shy on that a little bit. I want to talk about mystery religions just because they're interesting.
Yes.
You might even, you know, especially those who are involved in internet disputes with other people, you know, you're going to find people out there who are like, well, Christianity is just a little like one of many mystery religions out there. What's a mystery religion, A, just to define it? And then B, what's one of the ones you find most fascinating from the ancient world? And then how do we then, as kind of a third part of that, how do we respond to people who say it's just another mystery religion? How is Christianity quite different from mystery religion? I'll remind you those questions. Three at once is too many. So first of all, what is a mystery religion?
Yeah, good question. I think one of the challenges is we don't have a lot of information about these because they were kept secret. So let me say, when I talk about Roman religion, I'm talking about state and public religion. So this was the obligatory religion of society, the Pax Deorum, peaceful coexistence with the gods. And in general, people didn't expect to have a personal relationship with God. Like we talk about that today, you can have a personal relationship with God, that's Christian. Well, the mystery religions were actually catering to people that did want to have a personal relationship with a God. So this is where we get into things like ecstatic experiences, this idea of like, I want to touch the soul of divinity and have a kind of otherworldly experience. And so these were often foreign religions out of Egypt or Greece or the Middle East. And they were kind of imported into the Greco-Roman world. And they met in private or hidden locations like caves. And the promise was, hey, join our secretive group. It was going to be exclusive. So not everybody can do it, right? There's a wait list. You pay some fees. You know, you meet us here at the secret location. Again, we don't know a lot of the details. We just know things second, third hand, hearsay, some fictional things. And then you take some drugs or eat some herbs or drink some drinks, and you can kind of commune with divinity. We hear rumors of human sacrifice, of murder. So this is going to be kind of really edgy, bizarre, kind of weird stuff. And the promise was you can experience spiritual ecstasy through this secretive private thing. And there was usually kind of tiers. You start as initiate and you kind of go up the ladder.
Well, what's an example of one that just jumps to your mind or one of your ones that you think is most interesting or a favorite?
Yeah, there's Egyptian ones called the Cult of Isis. And this was popular in places like Thessalonica. And Isis was pretty popular all around. If there was ever going to be a deity that kind of captured people's passions, Isis would play a big part of that. Female deity that was seen as kind of a powerhouse. And we do have some stories about her. And she promises things like eternal life and salvation.
Ovid's Metamorphoses, right, tells the story of Apuleius, and he gets turned into a donkey in the story, but he gets the opportunity through an encounter with Isis, right? This is all right, I'm remembering correctly.
Yes, you are.
Gets the opportunity to be transformed back into a human, but it's through his ecstatic encounter with her, right, that she promises such things. All right, now finally then, like, how do you answer this internet person who's saying Christianity is just a mystery religion? How's it different?
Yeah, I would say there are some similarities. There are some recognizable similarities. The individualization of religion, the idea of internal heart, spirit, soul kind of stuff would be similar. So I think Christians had to answer for this. I talk about a critic of Christianity in what people think is a fictional dialogue by Minucius Felix, I think end of second century, a critic called Caecilius. Caecilius uses the kind of slur language for Christianity that seems to parallel it to a mystery religion. So I think there are some similarities. I think the big differences are these mystery religions, they hurt people. I mean, there's sacrifice, there's drink and drugs, and Christianity, they actually want to be public. And so you read the Book of Acts, you read Justin Martyr, you read Chrysostom and others, they want to create public dialogue. They're actually more similar to Josephus in that sense, where he wants to create, and Philo, they want to create public dialogue about their religion. They don't want to keep it a secret. They do some secretive things, they meet privately, but second, they don't want to harm people. So you have, like, Paul's speech in the Book of Acts, test me, 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, follow me around. Check out what I'm doing. There's no secret. Number three, it's not an initiate sort of situation. Once you're baptized, you're in. Like, that's it. There's no... So look at Galatians where Paul says, did you start in the spirit and now trying to end with the flesh? That uses the language of climbing a ladder of religion, progress in religion. Paul says, we don't really operate that way. And I think just the Great Commission, this idea that we want to be everywhere. We don't want to be an exclusive club. We want to be everywhere. Probably my favorite difference is, even though mystery religions pitch themselves as appealing to the lowest in society, like slaves or criminals or foreigners, they still had, from what we understand, they still had dues and they still had like membership barriers and dues. And Christians didn't. And so I think Justin Martyr or Tertullian, I can't remember, one of the two had said, you look at some of these other groups where they use the money for themselves, but we use our money to help other people. That was one of the things they actually used to differentiate themselves from other groups.
Yeah. So instead of meeting, like maybe a mystery religion is like Burning Man in the current climate, and Christianity is more like a potluck in someone's home where you're worshiping Jesus and trying to live in virtue, not in license. So anyway, quite different flavor to all of that. Now, I kind of wanted you to give a final statement for us, Nij. I think we should all agree and can all agree that Christians shouldn't just be weird for the sake of being weird. But at the same time, if we're not weird in ways that mirror ancient Christianity, and we kind of want to lop that off for cultural compromise sake, we've kind of lost our way too. We need to preserve the uniqueness of Christianity in terms of its truth, its values and missions from the ancient days until today. What do you think are some of the most urgent ways that we have to stay weird in the midst of our contemporary culture? Where do you see our temptation to lop off what's weird, and where do we most urgently need to stay weird?
Well, Matt, you're going to like my answer here, because the two words that I would recommend that people process after they read my book is allegiance and culture. So allegiance meaning we Christians are called to reach out to all people in all places, but we subscribe to worship only one God, the triune God. And we can't have allegiance to that triune God and have allegiance to Caesar or to America. I know that's controversial, but I actually, even though I'm proud to be an American and I'm American born, I think we just pledge allegiance to Jesus Christ and everything else will fall in place. We don't need to pledge to a flag or a country or anything else. So I think we have to get our allegiance in order. Now, that's not enough because we have to know who we're pledging allegiance to. So that means we have to know scripture and we have to know the great Christian tradition to understand how our priorities are set by scripture, by Jesus, and not just sort of what our preferences are, what cultural preferences we have. So that's where culture comes into place. I think the great problem we're experiencing in America is, number one, biblical theological literacy in the church. And then that once we gain literacy, then we can commit people to that. But if I were to say what we actually need, I think is to return to a rule of faith and a Christian catechesis, whatever you call it, if you don't like that word. But we need to subscribe to rule of faith. I go back to Dale Allison's statement when he talks about the historical Jesus. We can turn Jesus into anybody we want if we cherry pick verses. You can make him into the Republican Jesus or the Democratic Jesus or, you know, divine Jesus or human Jesus. You can make it anything you want. But if we have a rule of faith, if we're on the same page about a Christian theology of how we live, who Jesus is, then we're going to live in the Jesus way properly. And that's going to make us weird in some ways, but hopefully compelling and attractive. So some recommendations. I wonder when I go on social media and I see what Christians say to each other or what Christians say to the world, I wonder if they've actually read the Sermon on the Mount. And so I would pick some key texts like the Sermon on the Mount, the fruit of the Spirit, maybe the book of James, maybe Deuteronomy. Sit with these texts, spend some time studying them and say, how does this establish a certain culture among the people of God and how we honor and worship Jesus? And then go from there. And so for someone who wants to do something really practical, I'm becoming more and more appreciative of John Mark Comer's new book, Practicing the Way, which gets into how to implement some of the things I'm saying. He doesn't talk about my work, but how to implement some of the things that I'm saying in the church today.
Well, that's fantastic. We need to stay loyal to Jesus need to sort out subordinate loyalties, I think, underneath that, right? That's part of the trick is like, how do we sort out subordinate loyalties? And I like how you front the rule of faith, which obviously we have that as part of Christian tradition, but it's obviously constructed from Scripture. Yeah. So your real emphasis on just kind of sitting with Scripture and allowing that to form Christian culture. Well, thanks so much, Nijé, for being here with me today. You've been listening to On Script, hosted by Matthew Bates. My guest has been Nijé Gupta. We've been speaking about Nijé's new book, Strange Religion, How the First Christians Were Weird, Dangerous, and Compelling, published by Brazos Press in 2024. If you prefer to support On Script through purchases, you can follow the link for purchasing on our webpage. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to On Script, delectable conversations on scripture and theology. If this episode has brought you inner peace or lit your biblical fire, please consider a small donation of just $2 or $5 per month. Information on how to donate can be found at onscript.study/donate.